Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
This is The Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Athletic Baseball Show for Friday, December 9th. Derek Van Riper here with Keith Law. On this episode, we'll discuss some of the fallout from this week's winter meetings. We had another big signing that went down on Thursday. Brandon Nimmo stays put with the Mets. We'll talk about that. The other moves the Mets have made so far this offseason. We'll get into Carlos Rodon and the difficulty of projecting health in an offseason where contracts have been longer than we've seen in a very long time for top-end talent. I think that's particularly challenging with injury-prone players, guys that have extensive injury histories, and Carlos Rodon, unfortunately, is one of those players. Not a lot of prospects on the move so far. We'll talk about at least one that was traded recently in Justin Henry Molloy. And we'll dig a little deeper into Boston's farm system, kind of a carryover question from yesterday's show that really makes sense to talk about with Keith because it has a lot to do with the future of the Red Sox and just how bright it really might be with the prospects they currently have in place. Keith, how are you doing?
I think I'm recovered.
You sound better than everybody else who went.
Yeah, because I wasn't there as much as they were. So that's probably why.
Yeah.
I've been home for 48 hours already. So
you've had a few normal sleeps at home.
Sort of. Define normal, right? I have kids. It's never normal. You'll find out.
Sure.
You'll find out soon.
Yeah, I know that the 38 years of wonderful sleep that I've been able to enjoy, those days are over.
Yeah, it's done. You're toast. Never get him back.
Let's start with Brandon Nimmo. Mets fans may be sleeping a little better right now. 8 years, $162 million for those who really like years and dollars. I think Nimmo has become an offensive player kind of similar to Christian Yelich. Defensively, there's more value because he plays center field. Mm-hmm. And I think it fills a clear need, even though he was there last year, because the problem I felt if Nimmo went somewhere else, an obvious replacement wasn't really out there in free agency. So what do you think about the player Nimmo has become over time, and how long do you think he can sustain a level close to what we've seen over the course of these last couple of seasons?
Yeah, well, I think if he, and I did write a short thing that went up Thursday afternoon for folks who subscribe to The Athletic, just a paragraph, because it's just a re-signing. It doesn't have quite the same impact as a player changing teams, at least. But it's that if they get, you know, 140, 150 games of Nimmo for each of the next couple of years, they'll get more than their money's worth. He's like a $25 to $30 million player. I mean, maybe a little bit more. It's always hard to say what exactly a player is worth to it because he's worth a different amount to every team. But this AAV seems to underpay him a bit, which is probably, you know, they lengthen the deal out so their salary cap hit would be lower. But then that also really kind of increases the risk because this is a guy who's, he's a really good player on both sides of the ball, particularly his non-base machine. He's always been like that, but he just continues to get better. And over the last 2 years has shown, after really not hitting lefties well at all early in his career, and the Mets didn't let him face a lot of lefties, he can. He is no longer just a platoon player. But he gets hurt a lot. And he's played 100 games or more twice in his major league career. And that's a huge red flag for me when going long term on a guy. I would go short term, sure. But the two main reasons you don't really want to go long term on somebody are they're really old or they get hurt a lot. And, you know, 8 years, even if you say, well, this is really just 6 years and they're just spreading out the money. Okay. 6 years of a guy in his 30s. See, Bias Cat doesn't like it either. 6 years of a guy like Nimmo who gets hurt a lot. That's still pretty optimistic. He's going to miss a lot of time in the deal. And that's why I agree with you. There was not a great replacement available for him on the market. But at the same time, that's a lot of money and a lot of commitment. Particular. I understand Steve Cohen's money. Nobody cares. And this is also not saying Brandon Nimmo doesn't deserve it. Great for players to get paid. But I'm just looking at how much value is Nimmo likely to return over the course of this deal? And I think it's more likely to not work out. I understand that's true of most free agent contracts, but there are specific factors about Nimmo that worry me, despite the fact that I really like the player he is when he's fully healthy.
Yeah. And I wonder if for many of these contracts, I mean, anything that's 8+ years, regardless of the present ceiling of any of these players, what's the realistic hope do you think teams are modeling out at the end of these deals? If Brandon Nimmo is a 1.5 to 2 win player in years 7 and 8 of the deal, that seems like a pretty big success, right? I mean, same holds true for Trey Turner and Xander Bogaerts and Aaron Judge too, I think, all to similar degrees. Like, if that's the type of player they are at the very end of the contract, so long as they are something resembling the player they've been at their peak up to this point for the first half of the deal, or even for a few years at the beginning of the deal, it can work out, air quotes, from a value perspective. But I think expectations at the end of the deal are understandably low because so many players that in the past have received these long, long deals that carry into the late 30s, early 40s, we see those players get designated for assignment. We see those players, even if they're first ballot Hall of Famers, struggling to earn playing time. So I think our minds tend to go to those cases and just assume, well, that's going to happen at the end. The fun part is there's a lot of time before the end. And I threw this out there earlier in the week. Do you think there's a more urgency for a lot of teams just because we've been in this sort of limbo the last couple of years, going into the new CBA, the pandemic shortened season? Do you think there's just a unique combination of factors that has led teams to be more willing to make these longer term commitments to say, we don't care about year 7, 8, and 9. We're here for the first 5 to 6 years of the deal because we're trying to win now and we'll deal with the cost later. Plus, as we know, luxury tax thresholds will go up, right? The value, mm-hmm. the cost of a $25 million player 8 to 10 years from now, it won't be as harsh as it is in the present day. So that kind of works in this as well.
The Turner deal to me, of all the deals we've seen so far this offseason, is kind of the most instructive along the lines of what you were talking about because, yeah, it's 11 years. But has there ever been a more transparent attempt to game the luxury tax than paying Trey Turner, who's a $40+ million player right now, what is it, $28 million a year AAV? Because they don't care. What's the last 3 years of that deal are just deferred money, basically. Now, it's a little different in the sense that you know, he could still be soaking up a roster spot. And that's always an issue I think people underestimate is teams really don't like to release players who've become unproductive when they have a couple of years left on their deal, a couple of years of big money left on their deal, because it's real hard to go to ownership, especially if you're the one who signed the player to the deal in the first place. Real hard to go to ownership and say, yeah, that deal we gave, it's not, I don't think it's going to be this bad for Trey Turner, but say that it is. Yeah, Trey Turner isn't even worth the roster spot anymore. But we got 3 years and 70-something million left to him. A lot of owners are like, oh, okay, release him and then pack your desk. There's a real psychological, and I'm just not saying it's rational, but a real psychological impediment to just walking away from that player. And then he's just taking up spots on your 26-man roster and on your 40-man roster. So there are arguments against it. But I looked at that Trey Turner deal of all these deals and said, yeah, I don't really care the length of the deal, because if you rethink that as a 7 or 8 year deal, a period during which I really do think Trey Turner is going to hold a lot of his value, especially since he hasn't lost any speed at all so far in his major league career, then I'm good with that one. The Judge deal to me is the other end of that, right? I think even if you rethink the Judge deal is, what was it, 9 and 360, you say, well, it's really about the next 5 years. Hey, this guy might decline/get hurt a lot in his next 5 years. Players as big as he is, don't have much track record of staying healthy and productive into their 30s at all. They don't know, a lot of them don't even make the majors. He's in a fairly small class to begin with, but he's a player I worry about in the short term as well as the long term. Whereas guys like Turner, and I'm guessing this will probably be true whenever Carlos Correa signs, they're going to be so good in the short term that I'm much less worried about what the last few years are like, particularly if those years are really just about spreading the money out, where you're talking $27, $28 million a year versus $40 million a year on the Aaron Judge contract.
So I went digging in the old Stathead database because I was wondering how many seasons have we seen in the expansion era since 1961 from players aged 35 or older? How many seasons have we seen that are at least two win seasons by Baseball Reference WAR, right? So some players did it several times. Barry Bonds did it seven times. Brian Downing did it seven times, which never would have come up with that. Two wins is a reasonably low threshold, but it just means being productive at a very late age. Like, you're happy with a two-win player. Most teams are fine with a two-win player at a spot.
Right, right.
A lot of Hall of Famers, David Ortiz, Chipper Jones, Edgar Martinez, Hank Aaron did it six times, Willie Mays did it six times, right? So there are decent numbers of players that were good enough late in their career where I can start to understand if you have a present day five war sort of value, you could age gracefully enough. Some of it's going to come down to health, just how well does your body hold up? And we have more questions, I think, about Carlos Correa because of what's happened to him so far than we do about Trey Turner, right? I think the injury history of players, position players, pitchers, doesn't even matter which it is, that is the hardest part of figuring out what's really going to happen in the future. It's the worst wild card, the worst variable to try and account for. And I'm still fascinated by the Jacob DeGrom deal, Keith. 5 years for Jacob DeGrom. Is that a sign that the Rangers see something that they are encouraged about in his arm? Is it a sign that they just want to have their guy and that's what it took to get him? What does that mean? Does that tell us anything instructive about the potential future health of DeGrom that he's able to get a deal that long?
I think it was just, I don't like the deal. I think in the Mets case, they can, I think I even said, if you're a Mets fan, like, you're upset because he's one of the best pitchers in the history of the franchise. So this guy's 35. He's already had one Tommy John. We know there's probably damage to the UCL. And he also missed a lot of time with the shoulder issue. There are so many reasons not to be going long-term on him. And this just seems very much like the Rangers saying, we need a top flight starting pitcher. Just give him whatever he wants without much regard to that. DeGrom deal is not going to look good. It's very unlikely. Now, you know, if DeGrom rolls out a healthy, full healthy season this year, and I don't know how likely that is because these medical questions, these injury questions had the last 2 years are still pretty current. But if he makes 30 starts this year, he might win the Cy Young Award. And then everyone's going to be like, what a great deal the Rangers got. And they'll be able to say, look, yeah, we got him for four more years. We're talking about the probability right now. What do we know right now about this player? And what is the probability of him making 30 starts this year, 30 starts in any year, in any number of years? How many starts do you think he makes over the course of the deal? It's real hard to make the math work out if you're trying to, and it's all estimates, but if you're estimating the probability of him being healthy. He's been good whenever, basically whenever he's pitched, except for some very short periods of time. If he takes the ball, he's probably going to be good. He just doesn't take the ball that much. He hasn't even pitched basically a full season, the equivalent of a full season over the last two MLB seasons. So how can you possibly look at that player and say, yeah, we're going to get 120 starts, remember, over the next 4 years? That seems crazy to me.
There's a whole bunch of other things that can change. With DeGrom, I wonder, now that he has a five-year deal and he's 34. Is he going to back off trying to throw at or near his max velocity as often as he has in the past? Could we find like a self-restriction from DeGrom that could be better for his own health? I've wondered if that's been part of the problem the entire time. It's year over year over year. He's thrown harder and harder. He's defying the aging curve that way, but it seems to come at this steep price of all this missed time. I mean, 26 starts over the last two seasons combined. The Rangers took on a lot of risk with Andrew Heaney as well because it's only a two-year deal. It's a lot less risk than what they did with DeGrom. And Heaney sort of fits more into the model of the pitching that they have been going after in free agency in recent years. And they've had a lot of success of shopping in that mid-range and getting decent numbers of high-quality innings. They've just never had enough of a rotation in recent years to get over the top and to become contenders. How do you see this roster coming together? Big spenders last winter, big spenders again this winter, probably not done too. I think it's pretty easy to see a corner outfielder landing on this roster between now and opening day as well. But how do you feel about the Rangers in the AL West with their latest round of additions?
Yeah, the Heaney deal, I mean, another one, like how much can we possibly bank on this guy? God, was it Joe Sheehan who said we're just paying on this sort of per inning basis, right? That it is, we're just finding the guys who are most effective on a per inning basis and hoping they can pitch as much as they pitch more going forward. Cause Heaney's, you know, very much like that, like on a rate basis, on a pitch by pitch basis, right? He's got these, you know, huge strikeout rate, huge swing and miss rates. Also gets hit extremely hard when hitters do square it up, when he's in the zone, which definitely concerns me. And he's got little to no history, recent history of staying healthy. That's fine. You give that guy a 2-year deal. Sure. Sure. It's like Verlander, 2-year deal. Sure. Well, Verlander, obviously not quite the same, right? He won the Cy Young Award this year, but you know, 1-2-year deals, you're never going to hear me say a 2-year deal is too long for a player. I might say the amount of money guaranteed is a little much. It's when you get to 3 years, there's a little bit of an inflection point there, because I think projecting that far out is difficult. But of course, if you're the Rangers and your big signings are Andrew Heaney and, you know, another guy like him, what are you selling at that point, right? You sell Jacob DeGrom. Hopefully you sell a lot of tickets and you sell this idea that, no, we're going to be a contending team. And I think they're closer to a contending team this year. I don't think they're anywhere close to the Astros. They're probably not. They probably haven't caught up to the Mariners, and the Mariners aren't as good as the Astros for me right now. So, you know, I think I agree with you. I think they've got a ways to go. I think the Heaney deal just sort of makes more sense for where the Rangers really are, but the Rangers are trying to be somewhere else, right? They do not want to be a 90 plus loss team again. They are, no, we're contenders, and we're going to spend whatever it takes to appear to be contenders going into the season.
They've got a good mix of young players. They've got a few pitchers that could emerge to be part of the rotation at some point this season. Josh Young, finally fully healthy for an offseason that came up at the very end of last season. I think he's kind of a big part of their future as well. So you put those pieces around some high-end talent. You could see, I don't know, 85 wins probably with what they've got already. And that's good enough to be right around that last wild card spot. If they add more and they make some trades in season, then you know they could change their fortunes even more. So it looks like a great time to be a Rangers fan, just given all the things they're kind of doing in unison right now. At least the timing of all the moves in Texas makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
The way they're spending, when guys are coming up, that fits. And we can't necessarily say that about every other club out there right now. Keith, I think this is the second offseason in a row where the Cubs are making moves, they're making additions, and then they're not doing certain things that make you say, what is the overall plan here? And I think they're still in the mix for Carlos Correa or Dansby Swanson, and that would change a lot about how people think of their offseason so far. But they're kind of walking the line awfully close to what they did last winter, where by about March, you and I sat here and said, are they better? Are they kind of good? Are they good enough because of the NL Central? It's an incomplete right now, but how do you feel about what they have done up to this point?
I like what they've done. I don't know that it really moves the needle a ton for them going into this year. Like, they're slightly better. They might be a little more than slightly better. I might be underselling them a little bit. They are a better club. They need to do more. And that could be it could be one big move. It could be several smaller moves. Certainly. I like Jameson Taillon. I actually think there's some more upside coming there. I think he has, after got 2 Tommy Johns and multiple other injuries, and there's not a lot of guarantee of workload with him either. But I also think he's one of the few starting pitching options in free agency this year where you could look and say, this guy might still have room to improve, because typically guys to get to free agency, right, they're finished products. And he showed some things in the last 2 years, and even more so in the last year, that made me say, there might be another gear here, particularly in terms of command, which I think has been continuing to improve. And he's on the verge of having the best command of his career, I would say. And I think he's now kind of discovered what kind of pitcher he has to be, especially as his stuff has changed as he's gotten older. I have no idea what to make of the Bellinger deal. Like, good luck, right? We have no idea what's happened there. Was it all the shoulder? Is it it's hard to believe that the guy went from MVP to a non-tender in such a short period of time. And frankly, if the money had been different, he would have been non-tendered sooner. He's just not been good. I also understand kind of no such thing as a bad 1 year deal. And he could be, you know, could be a pretty great pickup for them. And as I said, in my little note on him, there's two places you can play him too. He's perfectly capable of playing center field, which is what they've intended, what they've said they intend to do with him. He's also an elite defensive first baseman. And I think right now they don't really have an incumbent first baseman on the depth chart. I looked at MLB the other day. They're listing Matt Mervis, who's a borderline prospect in the Cubs system right now. And if you're contending, are you handing first base to him? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe if that's the only place you're playing a rookie, you're willing to do that. Signing one of the big free agents would be, you know, that's a difference maker, right? One, signing Carlos Correa, especially, that's a difference maker if they're able to do that. Signing Dansby Swanson helps. I don't know that it moves. It certainly doesn't move the needle anywhere as much. I think Swanson is there's a high floor there for me because of the defense, because I think the defensive improvement we saw from him last year and talking to people who saw him a lot last year, they believe that it is real and sustainable, but he doesn't have the ceiling of Correa. He doesn't have the ceiling of Turner. Frankly, I don't know that he has the ceiling of Bogarts. Bogarts, there's been some not great stuff in his batted ball data the last year or two, but he's also shown more upside, more star caliber offensive production. It's quite possible now that with change of scenery and change of coaching, maybe he'll get back some of that old power. I don't see that for Swanson, and I think he would move the needle less. He would be an addition. It would be improvement for the Cubs, but I don't think it's a scenario where that one wouldn't excite me as much if I were a Cubs fan. And I said in my piece too, I still think they need another starting pitcher. You know, Cubs fans seem to, based on the comments I got, really excited about Justin Steele. Great. It's, you know, this is a guy who was basically a fifth starter prospect all the way up through the minors, and he and Sampson and Wesneski, you take that whole basket of Cubs guys and one of them is going to turn into a number three starter. But I don't think any of them is certainly there. I'm certainly not saying they're all going to be like that going into next season. So I wouldn't mind seeing them going to get, you know, just go one tick down in the free agent starter market and get somebody who gets you some innings as you try to bring those pitchers along. And because the Cubs actually have improved their farm system quite a bit in the last couple of years, but almost all the guys of note spent the bulk of 2022 in high A. So they're not going to impact the big club for a while now.
2024 at the earliest for many of those players.
Probably.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Just based on what you're saying and then what the other folks in the fantasy community that I listen to a lot and talk to a lot, there's a divide between you and where they're at on Matt Mervis. There's a lot of hype on Matt Mervis. Like, he is, I can sort of tell in December who are going to be the people's sleepers. Matt Mervis is one of the people's sleepers right now, probably because of that path to playing time, right? There's not a lot there to compete with him. They saw him in the fall league. He had a good fall league, I believe, too. So that's probably a big part of it. But unless they bring in a veteran that is going to chew up a lot of that time, I could see them having to just go ahead and let him have 500 plate appearances or more. And if he hits, he'll keep the job.
Yeah. Not only did I see him, I spoke to scouts who'd seen him. I spoke to someone gave me some access to some of their batted ball and other data that's not publicly available. And all of it says to me, this is a, you know, I think I comped him to Dan Vogelbach, who's had a really nice big league career. For an undrafted free agent, that would be a great outcome for Mervis, but there is a ton of hype on him right now. And I don't think that's really justified. I don't see great bat speed. I think he's going to be, I think he's really going to get beaten with good velocity in. You know, I saw him hit 3 homers while I was out in fall league, and a bunch of them were like, you know, you're not going to see hanging breaking balls like that all the time in the big leagues. So it's very easy to look at, to basically scout a stat line and say, look at all the home runs he hit. Yeah, but is he going to see pitches like that? Maybe not as bad as the pitches I saw, but is he going to continue to see, is he feasting on below average pitching that he's just not going to see very much in the big leagues? He'd hardly be the first player to, who is slightly older, to kind of mash his way through the minors and get to the big leagues and find out, hey, pitching in the big leagues is a lot better than what it is in the minors. Which is not to say I'm rooting against him. He's a great story. If that guy gets to the big leagues at all, it's a great story. And I'm saying, I think he will probably bounce around for a while and be a useful bench piece for clubs for quite some time. Maybe it's, maybe he's a platoon guy. There's a lot of good potential outcomes for him that do not include him turning into the next Adrian Gonzalez or something. I just don't see it. I didn't see the athleticism. I didn't see the bat speed. I didn't see the swing that made me think he was going to get to that. I do think he's strong enough to, for power. Like, he could end up somebody who hits for a low average and gets to enough power that he starts for a bad team, right? A second division starter type. That wouldn't shock me. Vogelbach had some time when he looked like that. And that's probably helped extend his career too. But the folks who are all over him are, it's a lot of stat scouting, unfortunately. And sometimes that works. Sometimes it doesn't.
In Mervis's case, I mean, you play at the level to which you're assigned, right? So, you know, you do what you can, but I think your calls for some skepticism are warranted in this case. He was 24 years old last year, spending a lot of time at AA, got up to AAA, the K rate came down. The K rate wasn't as good at the lower levels too, so I don't know if I would necessarily buy the 15% strikeout rate at Iowa as a sign that he's going to come up and not strike out that much at the big league level either. I think there's a lot of things that could happen. It could be a long road of adjustments for him if he does figure it out. You mentioned before adding another starting pitcher. If they were to go and get one of Correa or Swanson, would you still think it makes more sense for them to stay below the Carlos Rodon level target? I mean, Rodon right now, it sounds like he's looking for 6 to 7 years. And I'll say this again, like, I want players to get paid. I want them to get as many years and as many dollars as they possibly can. His health history terrifies me. Similar to Jacob deGrom, if not worse, because he's had the devastating injuries already that have cost him lengthy amounts of time since he's come to the big leagues. So what would you do if you're the Cubs as far as choosing between Rodon versus the alternatives? And where do you see Rodon actually getting the deal that he wants when the dust settles?
I saw rumors. I don't track this stuff, right? I let other people chase the rumors, but 7 years, I couldn't. He's had real shoulder issues, and this guy was worked way too hard in college. I think once he got into pro ball, the White Sox, who have really a track record with pitching development, they did the best they possibly could with him. I think that probably from the moment he came into the organization, some of his fate was already written in the great baseball book that there was just going to be trouble. Hey, it's great to see that he got healthy, and I hope he gets paid because, frankly, he's been pretty underpaid. God, you think of the money, what we expected him to. I saw him as an amateur. He had one of the best sliders I've ever seen any college or high school player ever throw. And then by that was the summer after his sophomore year. And by junior year, he already kind of wasn't really the same guy, but he was still the best pitcher in the class. And also there was the hope, well, you just get him out of college and get him with some pro coaches and then maybe he improves a bit, et cetera. There's no way I could go 7 years on this guy. Everything we said about DeGrom, I think, also applies potentially to Rodon, maybe and then some, because Rodon's actually had the more significant shoulder injury. And that's, you know, we just treat, I know it's a very basic binary construct here, but elbows, shoulders, no. That's hard no on that. Someone's going to pay Rodon because he is already, I think, the best starting pitching option left on the market, right? And if you want upside, if you want a guy who might come in and give you 5 wins of production if he stays healthy, it's him or nobody. Am I missing someone? I think the rest have signed.
I would agree as far as that being, he being the last player with that sort of ceiling. Yeah,
right? there's lots of other starting pitchers I would like on the market. But, you know, if I'm the Cubs, I'm thinking like a Chris Bassett. I mean, he may even get more than I think he's actually likely to be worth, but he is more of a, here's some reliable innings to fill out the rotation. And that lets us mix and match with some of the young guys or see or test some guys out. You know, is Wesneski a starter? Is he a reliever? That, I mean, that's been attached to him since he was in A-ball in the Yankee system before the Cubs even acquired him. Well, then you can give Wesneski maybe a trial at some point. And if it doesn't work out, you're covered. You're not trying to roll out two or three really young / inexperienced guys in the rotation, which I'm fine with doing if you're not trying to contend. But if you are trying to contend, getting some length and getting some more certainty out of your rotation has real value.
I like that Wesneski's got a pretty deep arsenal of pitches. I think if you said bet today, is he a starter, long-term, or reliever, I'd be more inclined to bet on starter. I do think of the remaining free agent pitchers, looking at this group for a moment. Nathan Eovaldi kind of stands out to me as the guy that I like because he gives you a little bit of that ceiling. Yeah, you still got to take on some past injury risk, but I think he can be more impactful than a few of the other guys that are going to go around the same number of dollars for the same number of years. So if you're a fan of a team out there that still needs starting pitching, he would probably be the guy I'd be most excited about if my team signed him.
Yeah, because, God, was it just 21 that he was a top five pitcher in the American League?
Yeah.
I think it was 21 where I was arguing this guy should be getting, he should be on most Cy Young ballots. Yeah, absolutely. There's a bunch of those guys kicking around in free agency where it's like, this guy was pretty good not that long ago, and should we... Thank God, I thought Mitch Haniger was like that, who that was one of the better deals I think we've seen so far in free agency where the Giants just went 3 years. The AAV was fair, I think, probably reasonable for both sides. And they got a player who in 2021 was really freaking good. And, you know, in 2022, he wasn't that good, but he also wasn't healthy. And so it's one of those, God, if this guy just gets healthy again, and it was not the kind of injury that we expect to necessarily recur, you know, I think the Giants looked at Haniger and was like, well, that's a pretty good improvement. So they got nothing out of left or center last year at all offensively. That's good improvement. It's not a huge investment. It doesn't prevent us from going out and maybe grabbing one of the bigger guys, bigger names on the market, right? They were, as far as we could tell, they were in on Judge. They were in on Arson Judge, at least. And then, you know, maybe they're the ones to go after Correa, which make a ton of sense for them because Crawford, after the one bounce back year, he looks like he's toast. And he's done after this year anyway, contract-wise. So going to get a guy like a Haniger on a shorter deal like that, where you're basically just saying, we are just trying to get him back to where he was 1 year earlier, fine. I'm pretty good with that. You know, maybe I thought he would have gotten 2 years instead of three, but whatever. There is just a premium attached to free agency. I mean, I'm just, Alan Sepinwall just tweeted at me as we're having this discussion, basically saying they can't all be bad deals, right? Some of them, if that's just, you know, do we have to move the meter, so to speak? And my argument is kind of, but also this is just a function of baseball's weirdly broken compensation system where you're incredibly underpaid your first 3 years and then mostly underpaid your next 3 years. And then if you're good enough to get to the 6 year mark, you're probably going to get overpaid because clubs have been basically saving all this money on their pre-free agent players that they have lots of extra cash lying around to give nobody else to give it to. The only players you really can just give cash to freely is are players who are free agents. So some of the deals will still be okay. Some of them, you know, I think the majority of free agent deals probably end up disappointing the clubs who signed them. One way you try to avoid some of that risk is by shortening the duration. I'm actually always worried less about the AAV than about the duration. In the Haniger case, for example, going just 3 years, it's modest risk, not no risk, modest risk, and allows you to turn around maybe and then go after, hey, Correa wants 10 years like everybody else. God, he's the youngest free agent of all anyway. It's probably not even unreasonable to give him 10 years. But if you're the Giants, you're saying we're doing that once, right? We got one big commitment like that. We will do that for one player who have, you know, if they do with Correa, it's the best free agent on the market this year.
Do you have a smaller deal, smaller, just like less than 5 years that's been done so far this offseason that really kind of jumped off the page? Do you say, hey, actually, that's pretty good given this market or given who this player is that this team got this sort of deal in free agency?
Let's see. What did I really like? I mean, I said I like the Turner deal. That doesn't fit what you're talking about. I like the Josh Bell deal. I like the Jose Quintana deal.
I thought Bell was a good fit.
I had Bell over Jose Abreu. To me, younger, you know, Abreu, there were just little cracks in the foundation that make me wonder. And, you know, he's 36 going into this year, right? It is, hey, you're just basically saying you don't think this guy's aging. You think these little, the little evidence we see here that he might be slipping, you know, from the just the huge drop in home runs last year to some little stuff in the batted ball data that just is commensurate with a guy getting into his the back half of his 30s. You're just saying, hey, we don't think that's going to happen. Whereas with Bell, hey, he's been pretty up and down too. He's pretty good outside of the pandemic season, though, for the last three normal seasons that we've had. That's pretty, I thought that was pretty reasonable. And, you know, obviously a shorter duration, shorter risk. I think he had an opt out. So, yeah, that deal made a lot of sense to me. Quintana to the Mets, kind of exactly the guy that they needed. And, you know, he was another one basically for like 4 or 5 years was just not very good. And then last year, with a bit of a change in the mix, in the pitch mix, turned out to be valuable, productive. And they gave him a 2-year deal. You just got to do that two more times, one and a half. They get 1.5 good years out of him. It's probably justified. And also the Mets had the benefit of that's what they needed, right? They already have two guys who are probably going to the Hall of Fame at the top of the rotation.
Yeah, two guys that will seemingly kind of push each other being teammates again too, which they don't really need that. They're hyper-motivated.
I was just saying, those guys are not exactly known for being soft, just resting on their laurels.
No, they don't have that reputation, but I think it'd light a fire under Carlos Carrasco to just keep pushing himself. He's underrated, I think, at this stage of his career.
He's got a lot of talent. Like, he's your three? I'm pretty good with that. Mets fans should be, yeah, a lot of this is just money, right? Mets fans should be pretty happy with where the team is now. They basically got the band back together. They lost DeGrom. They got Verlander. That might be a pretty good trade-off, actually. I mean, who's you got to put $100 on which of those two guys has the better, more valuable season. You can pick your war variant, which of those two guys. Who are you putting it on?
Verlander because of the innings. I just have more confidence in getting 175 innings from Verlander.
Same.
At this stage of their respective careers, which is, yeah. I realize how ridiculous it is to say that about someone who's going to be 40 in February. And I'm still fine with that because we're not talking about these chronic arm problems. I mean, I forget who brought this up. I know Britt mentioned it on the 3-0 show, but it was Dusty Baker said it to her. Verlander's got a new arm. He just had Tommy John surgery. It's not like that. I'm tongue in cheek, right? But it's at this phase where it's like he's about as healthy as you could be for having that kind of mileage.
The warranty on the new UCL is the warranty is limited. I don't think it's as extensive as the warranty on the one you were born with necessarily.
Right.
But it's fresh for right now. And if you're the Mets, you are looking at Verlander and saying 2 years, right? It's 2 years. If we get 320, 330 innings out of this guy over the next 2 years, plus some playoffs, it's a huge win, right? And it's just money deal. But you're getting the guy who just won the Cy Young Award. And it is always possible with anyone his age, he just shows up 1 year and it's just over. I remember Pat Henkin wasn't even that old. And we gave him a 1-year deal with the Jays. My boss at the time just desperately wanted to bring him back. And the poor guy showed up and he was like 82, 84, and it was just over. You know, that can happen. All indications on Verlander are it's probably good as new, at least for the very short term. And the Mets' time horizon is so short also. That's another big difference between this deal and the Nimmo deal. Whereas the Nimmo deal, obviously, you hold serve with last year, right? You had him last year, you have him this year. But 6 years is way beyond the Mets' current time horizon, right? It's win now. They came so close. They were so good up until September 15th or so of this year. You're just trying to, you really, if you could just put the whole team back together again, right? And redo it. Maybe you just get a little farther. A ball bounces, a little luck one way or another. That's, I think, all you're trying to do if you're the Mets. And I think they've done that. I look at this team and say, they're not any worse than they were last year. And didn't they win 100 games? I'm good with going back to battle with this group.
I think if you are top five team based on projected war going into the season, you're one of the favorites to go win a World Series. That's as much as you can reasonably do. When you look at a future just 3 years down the road, 2025, you know, Scherzer's deal will be up. He'll be a free agent again going into that season. Verlander will have his option year, so maybe you've got one more year of Verlander. You'll still have Francisco Lindor with plenty of time left on that long-term deal. You'll still have a few years of Edwin Diaz. You'll be in the last year of the Starling Marte contract. Mm-hmm. You'll still have several years of Brandon Nimmo. Mm-hmm. Pete Alonso will be a free agent. Carlos Carrasco will be long gone by then. The Quintana deal will run out by then.
Yep.
So you're basically going to be down to your club control players. They don't have that many young club control guys in the big league mix right now that you see as long-term pieces. It'd be Brett Beatty and Francisco Alvarez, right? That's kind of it as far as their mm-hmm. their long-term core. So you're right. I mean, they're playing for the right now, and they may have a quick reload 3 years from now, depending on how everything else goes with the organization. And there's a ton of factors in play, but you could see these next two seasons being kind of critically important for them to try and get one of those titles.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. It is. And I'm not looking at this Mets team too and saying, well, they better win in the next 2 years or it's all going to pot. But they're still not like that. They have been one of the most productive drafting teams in baseball over the last 6 or 7 years. And even though they've traded a lot of those guys away, there's still talent in the system. There's still guys coming. And so I don't think it's like that. I don't think they are going, I don't think they're headed for a cliff and they better win in the next year or two. However, they have definitely built a team that is very much trying to win in the next year or two. How could you be upset with that? If you're a Mets fan, you should be thrilled.
Still have a pesky Atlanta team hanging around right at the top of the NL East too.
Wait, and who won the pennant last year? I'm forgetting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you get injured, you don't want to wait for answers and options. That's why it may be time to explore the Nano Experience, a revolutionary treatment option designed to help active people get back to the lifestyles they love. Nanotechnology allows surgeons to see inside even the smallest joints and treat orthopedic conditions with a tiny camera and other nano instrumentation, all through a barely there poke hole incision. Wherever you've experienced an injury, whether it be a foot and ankle, hand and wrist, shoulder and elbow, knee or hip, nanoarthroscopy can be used to diagnose and treat your condition in an extremely, minimally invasive way. Don't wait to learn about the revolutionary Nano Experience and how it could help you or someone you know after an injury. Visit arthrex.info/theathletic. This is not medical advice and is not meant to be a substitute for advice from your physician. Talk with your physician about your health condition, potential surgical risks, and whether Arthrex products are right for you. Postoperative management is patient-specific and dependent upon your physician's assessment. Individual results will vary.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is meme mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
Not a lot of prospects have been traded. The winter meetings were a little underwhelming from a trade perspective, but I also think when teams are shopping in free agency like this and spending, and there's so many contenders for a lot of free agents, I think that can hold up trades because trades require you to give something up. So why would you give something up when you could address a need with money? So I think we'll see trades soon. I think that's going to happen. We did see Justin Henry Molloy get traded to the Tigers as part of a trade that sent Joe Jimenez to Atlanta. Kind of an underrated addition to that Atlanta bullpen because Jimenez had a great season last year for the Tigers. Finally, after years of the expectation that he was going to step into the closer role and just become a shutdown guy. He kind of was that guy. And because they had a disappointing season, a lot of people may have missed that. But Justin Henry Molloy, the prospect going to the Tigers, what do you see from him and how long might it be before he can make an impact at the big league level?
Yeah, I liked him. I saw him in fall league. He's not a third baseman. I didn't see him play third base. I saw him play left field. And I think even that's going to be going to require some work, but he's got a real idea of the strike zone and he hits the ball pretty hard and did not see signs of struggle within the zone, right? I don't think this is one of those, well, he can take pitches that are out of the zone, but if you challenge him with good stuff in the zone, you can beat him. I think a lot of slightly older players, which is not him, or players at the wrong end of the defensive spectrum, which is him, they get by and put up pretty good stats in the minors. Nico Cavadas in the Red Sox system is a guy like this. He knows a ball from a strike. She's like, if you're not going to throw me something in the zone, I'm just not going to swing at all. And then puts up really strong OBPs in the minors. Nothing wrong with that. But then you get to a point where it's, wait, these guys have stuff and they can put it in the zone. And then that's the new challenge. You have to make an adjustment. I didn't see that with Molloy. He's going to miss, but I also think he can hit decent quality stuff. The only real question I had on him as a hitter was, this guy hits the ball really hard. Why aren't more of them ending up in the seats? But it was also his first full year in pro ball. He was in Georgia Tech last spring. So I liked that. I thought for 1 year of Jimenez to get him and then throw in, maybe a middle reliever at some point in Higginbotham. Great return for the Tigers, who have basically no use for Jimenez. Who cares if you have a closer, right? You're not winning. You're trying to turn things over a bit.
To get someone that could be a regular part of your lineup, that's a nice get. So I thought that was a good move for the Tigers, and I don't really see them going out and doing anything splashy money-wise. They did that a little bit last offseason, and they're just not there right now. New front office, new philosophies in place right now in Detroit. Mm-hmm. The question I was going to ask you, this kind of came out of yesterday's show. The Red Sox are one of those teams having a strange offseason so far. They did go out and get Masataka Yoshida, 5 years, $90 million. I guess we could start with him. What does Yoshida bring to the table? What kind of expectations do the Red Sox have for him as someone that either was underrated by a lot of people making free agent lists or is a guy that the Red Sox seem to like just more than everybody else?
So I've only seen video. I was floored. I don't know scouts who think this guy is a clear everyday player. Obviously, the Red Sox have some. I got a lot of punch and Judy hitter, plays pepper with the infield. He doesn't run. There's no power. It's that sort of swing that you see a lot on players coming over from NPB that doesn't really work here against pitchers here. Throw harder in general, and they come inside a lot more. That is just not as big of a thing in NPB. And if you have a guy who has that inside out kind of swing and you just bust him inside with velocity, unless he's Ichiro, he's going to struggle. And so, I heard a lot of extra outfielder. And hey, if you think this guy's a regular, got a chance to be a regular, okay. This basically pays him like he's a regular. And that's where I really, and plus we add on top of that, the posting fee they're paying over $100 million. And so far, that's the big move for the Red Sox this offseason. Like, if I'm a Red Sox fan, I'm thinking, the heck's going on? We used to be one of the top payrolls in the sport. We used to spend money to put the best team possible on the field, and we are not doing that.
The question then is, do they have enough young talent coming through to justify letting some of the top free agents pass them by, to let one of their own, Xander Bogaerts, go to San Diego? I really thought they were going to retain Xander Bogaerts. I was surprised that they weren't the team that got a deal done with him. I'd realize it's a long deal and maybe some ownership groups don't have an appetite for that and others do, but
yeah,
is the wave of talent coming through in Boston good enough to justify backing off free agent spending right now?
Well, just to your point too, because I wrote about the Bogaerts signing and said, what the heck are the Red Sox doing? And people say, wait, you're saying Bogaerts has a lot of risk associated with him and he might decline, but the Red Sox should have overpaid him. Well, yeah, as it turns out in this case, if you're going to overpay someone, overpay Bogaerts and not Yoshida. Overpay the guy who at least has recently been pretty good, maybe really good. He's got a chance to be a 5-win player another year or two, at least, maybe further. And he's yours, bird in the hand. Unless they see something in Bogaerts, which I've heard nothing. It seems like they made him several offers. They were just never close to what he ended up getting in free agency. I would much rather be overpaying him relative to what he's likely to be worth than overpaying Yoshida, where there's a chance he's just not worth much at all, right? If he's a 1-win player or less, you have just thrown a lot of money away. And people are going to say, oh, it's Rosny Castillo all over again. They're not really the same player, but I also understand the desire to make that comparison. The Red Sox have a couple of really, really interesting prospects in their system Tristan Casas is going to be the first baseman this year, I would assume. And I really like him. And I think he's going to be an average regular right out of the chute. And Marcelo Mayer is one of the top 20 prospects in baseball. He is their shortstop of the distant future. I don't think he would be a reason not to sign Bogarts. I think you sign Bogarts and play him at short. And then 2 years from now, when Mayer is ready, you move Bogarts over to second. They do have Nick York coming at second base. He had a really down, kind of disappointing year and wasn't really hitting the ball as hard as he had the previous year. I really like his swing, but he's got to hit. It's second base only, and it's not great. He is really going to have to hit to have value. That system is kind of on its way back, but it's not great. So that's the other problem that they're running into is they're not fully like a rebuilding club. They're sort of treading water. And it's so weird because we've had almost a 20-year stretch now of really a 20-year stretch, right? From 03 through 22, that's 20 seasons of them not treading water, of them saying, no, we're just trying to win almost every year. Obviously, they've had some disappointing years in there, but I don't think it was ever for lack of effort.
Yeah, because if you look at where they project right now, and you just tack Xander Bogaerts back onto the roster and say he's about a 4-win player, mm-hmm. they're right in the thick of it with other wild card teams, projection-wise. They'd be similar to the Phillies or the Mariners, or the Brewers, or the White Sox, the Rangers, the Twins. Those are all wild card caliber teams. And instead, they're just at the bottom of that group. They're arguably in, but arguably out. So they're definitely like one impact player away from being kind of a clear playoff projected team. When I can get Bias Cat on board.
He's got a lot to say. Yeah.
Yeah, we got to get him on more often.
We haven't even talked about many of the bird teams.
You got to tell him to earmuff it if you're going to say bird teams like mm-hmm. that. It's dangerous. I look at this Red Sox team and it's like, you're the Red Sox. Like your down years should be few and far between. Yeah. And you should still be competitive at the beginning. You should be a bubble team. Oh, it's not working out. All right, we're going to trade a few players away. And then we're going to come back with even more next year. That's what should happen. And maybe that's what they're doing. But I don't get the sense that they're necessarily going to go out and get Carlos Correa or Dansby Swanson or something impactful to make that sort of leap. And then you think about them as a team, Carlos Rodon for the Red Sox. I guess they do embrace injury risk, but that's embracing injury risk in the riskiest of ways, given the length of the contract we talked about earlier, that seems to be like what he's looking for. So I understand the frustration in this case. A lot of times I see the reaction from fans in December, and I think it's December. Mm-hmm. Like, just let it go. Red Sox fans are right to be upset right now, because it just seems like there's a little bit of a gap before we're going to see most of those impact prospects. Kind of seems like Casas is coming now, and Mayer another year at least before he's even in consideration for a regular spot. I mean, what kind of timetable would you put on him at this point?
On Mayer, I think it's 2 years. I really think he missed some time with injury. He certainly showed flashes this year where he was, good enough to sort of justify the hype, I guess, for lack of a better way to say it. Like he played up to his potential, but he also had periods where he didn't. I don't know how much of that was injury and how much was, hey, baseball's hard, right? There's a lot of adjustments to be made going from California high school into basically directly into full season ball, which is something we see a lot more now because Rob Manfred and company decided to wipe out the short season leagues. And now that we've lost that intermediate developmental step for players coming out of high school or for players coming from the DSL to the GCL or AZL, whatever, and then up to short season, like that's all gone. And so I think a lot of us have had to kind of change our recalibrate the way we look at players, just going to watch them playing at those levels because Mayer played well. I don't think he blew the league away, right? He didn't immediately establish himself as, hey, this is one of the five best guys in baseball. He may still get there. I think he's clearly got a lot of ability. He hasn't done that yet. He has not made that leap yet where you think, okay, now he's going to zip to the majors. I think he is for now. I'm saying 2 years on him. And it's probably true of York as well. I don't know that we'll see a lot of those, a lot of their other prospects, their non-Casas prospects before the latter half of 24. Contrast that to, we were talking about the Cubs earlier, who do have also a lot of prospects who are in high A, but some of those guys are going to move a little bit faster. Pete Crow Armstrong, just because of the defense in center, he might get there really quick. And then suddenly, hey, you know what? If he got there this year, I don't know that that's super likely, then you could move Bellinger back to first base. One of the reasons I really like the Bellinger deal is he gives you a ton of flexibility to move him around. Also, if he hits enough to be worth keeping, if he doesn't, you call up Crow Armstrong and you just call it a day. But I think that the Red Sox system, it's not bad. I feel like I'm running it down, but it's just not going to produce a ton of major league value in the short term beyond what they get from Casas.
Should they be among the teams that might be out there trying to trade for Sean Murphy?
Oh, absolutely. The Red Sox?
They don't have a long-term catcher on the horizon at all.
Nope, they do not. That is absolutely
true. So if you're
true.
Thinking about this year, like do that, because that's going to help you beyond this season, and it's a core spot. I think that would be a move that would change a lot about the way people are talking about the Red Sox to this point. And they're going to replace Nathan Eovaldi with someone. Like that's going to happen too. They're going to have more in the rotation, but you just see the way that rotation's built right now. You see a lot of injury risk with Sale and Whitlock and Paxton and Houck all on the depth chart. Some combination of those guys with Brian Bayo and Nick Pivetta, that's probably not enough in the rotation right now either. And part of that's because of Eovaldi. But the fact that they went out and added Kenley Jansen, Keith, that kind of tells me they still fancy themselves as some form of a playoff team. You do that plus Yoshida, that's why it looks like it's incomplete right now, but it's a frustrating path to whatever it is they end up doing.
I think that it's an incomplete, right? I don't grade off seasons. I'll leave that to people who are more interested in hot takes and clicks, but you got to give them an incomplete, right? And it almost feels like, what else could they do to give themselves a worthwhile grade, right? How are they going to be anything better than like a C+? If they go over pick, if they trade for Murphy, that might be one I'd really like, actually, because it's 3 years of him and he's really good. And Mike Petriello tweeted something that was just like, somebody please get Murphy out of Oakland Coliseum because he's just hit so much better on the road. That's such a bad place to hit. It's a bad place to play baseball, as it turns out. He could come to Fenway and actually be a bit more productive because he's not playing in one of the worst home run parks in all of the majors. That's one thing they could do. I'm glad you threw that out there. I mean, there's a lot of teams that should be after Murphy right now, and they are one of the better fits. And also, if they don't want to spend a lot of money, well, trade market hasn't really heated up yet. So maybe that's a guy they go after. Maybe they trade for a starter somewhere. We haven't seen Brian Reynolds move where the Pirates were like, we plan to keep him. That's good. That's funny. Why would you keep that guy? Everyone knows they should trade him. Yeah.
Yeah. We're talking about him last July as someone. And you looked at that depth chart and you said, well, just move him now because he's a good player and you'll get a lot back. And by the time the rest of your young players are contributing at the big league level, you'll have a better core because you went ahead and made that move. So everyone's incomplete right now, right? It's still very early, even though you want your team to be in on the most impactful player. Still a lot to happen. I think the trade market is where we're going to see some surprises in these next few weeks. That's going to do it for this episode of The Athletic Baseball Show. You can find Keith on Twitter at Keith Law. You can find me at Derek Van Riper. If you do not have a subscription to The Athletic, you can get one for just $2 a month for the first year at theathletic.com/baseball show. We are back with you next week.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.